B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
Guitarist Elliot Easton joins me today in the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Of course, Play With The Cars, now with The Empty Hearts. And on their latest record, they have a very special guest playing drums on one of the songs. It's just a former Beatle named Ringo Starr.
To come full circle and then have one of them play on our newest record is just an incredible gift, you know, just fantastic.
We talk about the latest album, as well as working with Detroit's own Wally Palmer, as well as their latest video, Come On and Try It, and more.
Any band is just the sum total of the members that are in. It's like the recipe. You put the ingredients in, and that's the recipe.
Speaking of that, the Cars never really changed band members.
I don't know. We were just like a quirky little band, and it would be unthinkable. It would have been unthinkable to us to like change a member. It's just like we were such a little, you know, unit and so tight with each other.
We talked about being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and oh, yeah. I had to ask him about Fast Times at Ridgemont High, moving in stereo in that famous scene.
They chose the song, and so now it's forever married to that image, but it had nothing to do with us recording it in England.
Right.
You know, while the Great East Coast Blizzard was going on in the winter of 77.
Guitarist Elliot Easton is my guest today on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock.
Talkin' Rock.
Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Ah, yes. Fun interview today with the legendary Elliot Easton from The Cars, and now, like I said, with the band The Empty Hearts, which is some really cool stuff. If you're into this real classic, kind of almost psychedelic kind of sound, maybe from the late 60s or something, it's really good. And Detroit's own Wally Palmer is in the band, like I said before in the intro. Also, Ringo Starr joins him for a track on this record. So some really good stuff from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member coming up here today on the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. I'll tell you what, man, I have a lot of interviews this week. So if you're into listening to rockers talk about their craft, this is definitely the podcast for you. I think I'm going to be talking with, I don't like to jinx myself, but I'm going to throw it out there and we'll see what happens. I'm supposed to talk with Mick Fleetwood tomorrow as I record this day on Monday. And also Rob Helford, whose book I'm almost finished reading. Loving his book. It's called Confess. And I do believe it drops tomorrow on the 29th of September as I record this. And I think that's going to be a really fun interview. I've interviewed Rob a bunch of times before, and he's a really super nice guy. And this book is pretty wild. Very, almost a little Joe Exotic, a little Spinal Tap-ish. You know, of course, on their way to, you know, becoming metal gods. There's a lot of stories and a lot of cool things in this book. So I'm going to talk to Rob coming up. And then I do believe one of Rob's former bandmates, John Five, was in a band with Rob in the mid-90s called Two, which was like kind of an industrial band. And it was the number two, W-O. That's how they spelled it. And so I'll be talking to John coming up here. Then I got some Instagram interviews as well. Which I'll tell you about maybe coming up here in the next few episodes of the podcast. In the meantime, on to Elliot Easton, The Empty Hearts. Their latest record is out right now. And like I start the interview off by talking about, this is a very classic 60s Traveling Wilburys meets ELO meets Beach Boys kind of feel to it.
Well, yeah, those influences are definitely there. I was thinking a lot about sort of 68 Beatles, like White Album, Lennon-y kind of stuff, like Happiness is a Warm Gun.
Yeah.
And things like those kind of things like with like tempo changes and like, you know, weird sounds and stuff like that. I'll tell you what, the whole idea for the record, or at least my concept behind the record, was to try to make one of those kind of classic records that we made. Well, I don't know how old you are, but that we grew up on, in like my high school years were 68 to 71. And so there was some pretty amazing music in those years. And when like an important new album would come out, say a new Beatle album or a new Stones album or Dylan, whatever it might be, an album that you and your friends are excited about, it's like a new movie coming out, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd go to like, you know, go to the department store or something, you'd get the record and go over whichever friend's house had the cool bedroom with posters and a good stereo and whose parents, you know, kind of were permissive. And, you know, and you turn the lights down, maybe light a little incense, maybe light something else, you know, and put the record on. And you'd play it from beginning to end, you and your friends, and you really wouldn't even talk. You would just listen to the whole record and study the album cover and read the liner notes and look at the artwork. And then, after, you know, and it kind of took you on a little trip, you know, like it started you off in one point and dropped you off somewhere else, almost like when the record was done, you kind of opened your eyes and went, whoa, that was a trip. You know, that was cool. Those kind of records, you know. And I'm not comparing us in any way, you know, to those bands or anything like that, but I'm just saying, like, the concept or the goal was to try to do that, where, like, and also, like, you know, being our second album, we were able to kind of, we expanded on kind of the sort of the concept of the first record. We got to know each other better as a band and what our abilities were, and as far as, you know, going pushing further out, you know, into what our limitations and pushing further in against those and doing more experimental stuff. And I always, you know, the Beatles, I guess it's sort of like a religion for me, the Beatles, so I use them a lot as an analogy, but it applies here, where I'm sure you'll agree, like, you could have a Beatle album and there could be like a 30s vaudevillian tune like Honey Pie, mm-hmm. and then a heavy rocker like Helter Skelter, and a beautiful, sensitive, finger-picking song like Julia or Blackbird, and then a crazy, psychedelic montage, a collage of sound like Revolution 9, and it all fit together, a country song like Don't Pass Me By, and it all sounded like the same band, but all such different kinds of music, but the unifying thing was it all sounded like them. And that's what I was shooting for with this, like to try to, you know, like experiment a little, like get some of the Rickenbacker 12 string in there and some Mellotron and this and that and some of those cool sounds and do some different types of songs, but it still sounds like the same band. That was the goal anyway.
Right. So I've talked about this before with a bunch of other people, but it seems like there's two bands, at least in the people. I'm 51, so in some of the guys I interview. So if you're in your 40s or 50s, Kiss was the band that inspired you. And if you're older than that, it seems like the Beatles. So were you inspired by the Beatles? Is that what made you get into music?
Well, I was totally inspired by the Beatles, but it's not what made me get into music. I was 10 when the Beatles played the Ed Sullivan Show, and that definitely sealed the deal. But my mom was a Juilliard trained singer, with her own radio show, and I grew up with music. And one of my cousins taught choir for 40 years in public schools, and there's a lot of musical people in my family. So I had a guitar from like 3. I'm not making those pictures of me playing left-handed as I do.
Yeah.
Three. And so I always, you know, at that point it was like, you know, Elvis and Cowboys and the Mickey Mouse Club and, you know, the Rock and Rollers too. But when the Beatles came on, that was just, there was something like a lightning bolt about it where, like, I don't know, for me, it was just like I could see like my future. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, now, I'm not making this up. I couldn't sleep that night. Like, my body was vibrating. Like, I just tossed and turned. And it was, like, one of those moments. It's really difficult for a first-generation Beatles fan to try to explain the excitement, you know, in contemporary times. Like, to be 10 years old living in Long Island when the Beatles get to New York, and it was so exciting. It was the only thing that was on TV or the news or the radio. It was insane. And it was just so great. You know, it's just, you know, that looks like a good thing to be doing.
Yeah.
And you know what else? It was unifying. Like, Ed Sullivan was on Sunday nights. So the next morning, you know, went to the school bus stop, and you get on the school bus, and you know how it is. It's very cliquish, and some bullies won't let you sit in the bench with you, sit with them,
yeah.
Or some guys will knock your books out as you're walking down the aisle and pick on you and this and that. That day, everybody was singing, "I Want to Hold Your Hand Together."
Mm. Wow. I remember Frankie Benelli from Quiet Riot told me this, almost the exact same story, that it was that, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm interviewing Rob Halford tomorrow, and I'm reading his book right now, and the Beatles, like, were his, like, linchpin. And then, of course, you guys get to work with Ringo on this record, Remember Days Like These. So talk about that.
Well, that was a great thrill. I mean, you know, going on from what I just described and what a milestone moment was to, you know, in my life, you know, for them to enter my life, to come full circle and then have one of them play on our newest record was just an incredible gift, you know, just fantastic. And the way it happened, it's not like, you know, you can just call up Ringo Starr of the Beatles and say, would you play drums on our record? But two of the band are friends with him, myself socially and Wally socially, and also toured with the All-Star Band.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So Wally had a working relationship with him, and the way it came about was really pretty naturally. It wasn't like a marketing idea, like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we get, Ringo Starr, you know, to play on our record. It wasn't that at all. We had that song, Remember Days Like This, and Wally said, you know, it really needs that big, floppy Ringo tom-tom feel with the, you know, that kind of slightly behind the beat, and that kind of loose but deep groove sound the way he had. He said, well, maybe you should ask Ringo to play drums on it. So he did, and Ringo agreed. You know, so he said, sure, and we sent the digital files, because it's all digital these days. You know, he was in L.A. It would have been logistically too difficult for us all to be able to watch him do it as much as we would have loved to.
Yeah.
But we sent him the files, and his engineer set the song up, and he sat down at his drums and put on his headphones and played to our song and recorded and sent it back, and there's Ringo on our song. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's so cool that the promo picture you guys have of all you guys standing there, and Ringo's on a picture in the background.
You know what's funny about that? That's also kind of a funny story. That's my family room we're all standing in.
Okay.
And I have all around the wall are the Richard Avedon pictures of the Beatles from Look magazine, you know, those beautiful psychedelic individual shots of the Beatles. They're like colorized. Lennon's like yellow and orange and pinwheel eyes. And you know the ones I mean?
Yep.
Okay. So the funniest thing, we took a picture standing in front of the sofa, and the one of Ringo was poking through. and this was just before anybody thought about like that he was playing on a song or anything like that. But then, you know, when they decided that we were going to make a single out of it, that picture was such a natural, it was so funny, that because it was just pure coincidence that picture was up on the wall. But then it was too much to license the photograph. Richard Avedon, you know, a fine artist.
Right.
You know, be like licensing Annie Leibovitz or something like that, or
right,
a Jim Marshall photo, you know. And so we couldn't afford that. So it was a picture of Ringo in there, but it was really this poster on my wall.
No, I mean, yeah, I'm such a huge Beatles fan. So I discovered him in 1980 when I heard John Lennon was killed. And at the time, I was about 11 years old. And ironically enough, the town I grew up in outside of Buffalo is where Mark David Chapman is in jail. Yeah, so it's like kind of a little bit of a meltdown fun fact, I suppose. But anyhow, I digress.
You know, I spent a year not too far from there. I went to Brockport State University near Rochester.
Okay, yeah.
You know, not too far from where you guys are, about 60 miles from Buffalo.
Yep, and now I've been here in Detroit since 1995, and of course, talk about working with Detroit's own Wally Palmer.
Oh, Wally's great. I mean, I'm sure you know Wally from being in Detroit, and Wally being, you know, an important member of the musical community here. So if you know Wally, you know he's a great guy and very talented, great sense of humor. He's a great hang and a fun guy to be in a band with, which is sometimes almost or just as important as musical ability. You got to be able to have fun with each other and get along, you know, when you're on a bus for 10 hours or stuck somewhere, and you know, you got to like each other, and we all do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that. I'm going to ask you about that in a couple of minutes here, but first I wanted to ask you about this, Come On and Try It, the video and stuff. It's so cool. It's got like this, like kind of like this ELO kind of vibe to the harmonies and whatnot. And then you guys shot that one over Zoom, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's all during this,
right,
you know, pandemic thing. So all we could do to create videos was use either existing footage we had or each of us shoot little iPhone or whatever videos and send it to the videographer. And he did they did an amazing job putting together these videos from, you know, little bits and pieces and current events and things like that, and somehow putting it together when we couldn't really get together on a soundstage or something and shoot a video or anything. So I think that, you know, they did a really good job with that.
Yeah, no, it looks great, man. It's cool. It's such a cool record. And like you said, it's got that that classic vibe to it for sure. So you just mentioned...
Yeah, I mean, you know, you might say ELO. I kind of think like more... Not that wouldn't be right, but also like maybe like Badfinger or, I don't even like that term power pop, but even Carsey is a little bit of a Cars kind of eighth note, dun, 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 which runs through a lot of Cars music. And it's just any band is just the sum total of the members that are in it. It's like a recipe. You put the ingredients in and that's the recipe. And so the Empty Hearts is what the four of us sound like with what we each bring to the group.
Right, each bring to the table. So,
yeah, it's just that particular brew, what those four people sound like together. You change one member and it will change.
Yeah, yeah. So you just mentioned something interesting that you were talking about how, you know, not only do you have to be able to play music, but you have to be able to hang with these people. So I interview a lot of bands, and it's amazing how few bands, actually, I should say, actually remain pretty much intact through their core. And that was the deal with the Cars. What was the ingredient in the Cars that all you guys, were pretty much together as a band, and there wasn't a lot of in and out and different things like that?
Yeah, I know a lot of bands could do things like that, like change lead singers and, you know, things as radical as changing a lead singer.
Yeah.
And stuff. Have success, like, you know, like with David Lee Roth, who's going to Sammy Hagar was an example, and having more hits. But with the Cars, I don't know, we were just like a quirky little band, and it would have been unthinkable to us to like change a member. It's just like we were such a little, you know, unit of, and so tight with each other and on the same wavelength that it would be like trying to teach someone to speak a different language or something. I don't know. We like when Ben passed, and may he rest in peace. Mm-hmm. There was no question of replacing him. Like we did a record after that moved like this record, and Greg and I did the bass, and when we played the Hall of Fame, we got the I always do this. The band that had Buddy Holly.
Weezer?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that's right.
Right. And so he came and played bass for us. He was wonderful. He did a great job. But, you know, there was never a thought of getting anyone to, like, you know, like a ringer or something like that, or get someone in there, you know. It was just, you know, then there was four of us, and now there's three of us.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. What was that? What was that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame moment like for you?
Well, I guess you could tell by talking to me as far as we've been talking that I take the whole music thing pretty seriously, and it means a lot to me, and it goes really deep with me. So it was a really moving experience. It was like one of those most amazing nights you could have in your life. Like to start out as a little kid of three and want to have a guitar because, like, Roy Rogers and the Cowboys have them, and then seeing the Beatles when you're 10, and then forming the Cars and getting to seeing the top of the mountain with those guys and sharing so many things, you know, and from Live Aid to the rest of it, you know. And you know, just having all those, so many people love the music and everything like that. To get to that stage that night, it's like, man, that's been a long, winding river. I'll tell you what, you know, you start as a little kid sitting in your bedroom trying to pick out licks on a guitar and moving the needle back and trying to learn, and all of a sudden you're standing there on some podium, you know, thanking people it's crazy, you know, but you know, unless you're like, I guess, really cynical about it, for me it was very moving, you know. I know that there's a tendency for people to kind of be cynical about it or say, you know, it's BS or what, this one should be in it and they're not, and this one is in it and they shouldn't be, and this and that. But all I know is that once they, you know, we got inducted, it felt really good, and it was really a pleasant, wonderful evening to share with my family too. You know, just to have my wife and my daughter and my sister there meant a lot to me. And it's just, you know, one of those lifetime things that only happens once. It was awesome.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, I've watched some of those things. You guys played Live Aid, by the way. I just, like I said, I'm reading Rob Halford's book, and he talked about Judas Priest playing that afternoon or something. So
They might have played the Wembley one, you know, we might have played because we played the JFK Stadium, Philly one.
Yeah, they were there in Philly was there like 2 days or something? I'm trying to recall. Or just the one day?
My recollection is that it was one real long day that started in England.
Okay.
One funny thing I remember is that Phil Collins played both.
That's right.
He jumped on the Concord. Like he played Wembley, then jumped on the Concord and flew and came to Philadelphia, and he played, I think, with Eric Clapton or something like that.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, Rob talked about it in his book because I guess they had like a 20-minute set. In 1985, Judas Priest was pretty big, as were the Cars. And so to get a 20-minute set. Hey, let me ask you about this. So obviously that scene in Fast Times at Ridgemont High with Moving in Stereo is so like iconic. Talk a little bit about that scene.
Well, I guess it's, you know, it's one of those things that, like, boys of a certain age will forever associate that song with B.B. Kate's, and the swimming pool. And, you know, it's like kids my age had the same reaction over Herb Alpert's record cover, Whipped Cream and Other Delights.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's almost the exact same thing. Like, that album cover was like my generation kids, you know, with Raging Hormones. That was a big one. And I think, you know, Fast Times, that scene was a big one for kids in the early 80s.
Did you guys feel an impact with, like, sales or people wanting to hear that song or anything like that from the movie?
I don't know if we felt it. I mean, you know, we were already selling lots and lots of records.
Right.
We got a lot of comments about it, and you know, I never seem to be do an interview where someone doesn't ask me about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was just the kind of thing. I mean, we made the record in the winter '77, and Cameron Crowe chose that song for a scene. Or whoever the music supervisor was on the film picked Moving in Stereo for that scene, and then licensed it from us and from the record label. That's how it works. And so they can put it on a soundtrack album and so forth. And, you know, so, it, you know, they chose the song. And so now it's forever married to that image. But it had nothing to do with us recording it in England.
Right.
You know, while the great East Coast blizzard was going on of winter of 77.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, the blizzard of 77. Yep, I lived through that. Yeah, that's for sure. Buffalo saw our fair share of snow when I was growing up right there.
That's the exact moment we were making the first Cars record.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, in London. We missed the blizzard. We were in London. We made that at Air Studios, George Martin's studio. And he would come in and listen and talk about, you know, being blown away.
I was going to say, yeah, wow.
Yeah, he'd like, you know, sit down on the sofa in front of the mixing console and, like, lie down and listen to the music. And we gave him a playback of some stuff, and he said, that's not bad, actually. And we like, oh, thank you, Mr. Martin. And then he left, and we looked a little down. And the engineer said, no, you don't understand that. That's his best compliment. That means he loved it. When he goes, that's not bad, actually. That's the best he ever says. And so we felt better about it. But Paul McCartney was in the studio next door for a while, and there was all these exciting things going on. But that's where we were there in that winter 77.
Man, so you've met, obviously, Ringo. And did you meet Paul out there at that recording?
No.
No.
No. Greg got to meet Paul. He played on Flowers in the Dirt record.
Okay.
Which is an interesting story because Drive had come out. And Paul was using the same engineer that we had used with Mutt Lange, one of the engineers we'd used.
Oh, yeah.
And Paul is commenting, he had this song called Motor Love, and he liked the sound of our song Drive, believe it or not. And the engineer says, well, I know the guy. I just did that record. He goes, well, let's get him over. And so they flew Greg to Paul's studio, you know, in Sussex, in England, and Greg got to, you know, play with Paul McCartney. So I didn't get to do that. I did play on Brian Wilson's first solo record, which was a thrill for me. But I never got to play with Paul, unfortunately.
So speaking of left-handed players, who are some of your favorite left-handed guitarists?
Oh, gosh. Well, my very first rock concert that I ever went to was Jimi Hendrix opening for the Monkees.
Wow.
At Forest Hills Tennis Stadium. So left-handed guitarist. Well, you got to say Jimmy. Albert King.
Mm-hmm.
Otis Rush. I don't really like pick out players because they're left.
Right. I was just asking to see what you're going to say.
Like who else is like? Doyle Bramhall Jr. is great. You know what I mean? Doyle plays with Clapton sometimes. Doyle Bramhall.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he plays left-handed. He's really good. Gosh. Left-handed, I don't know. Paul McCartney.
Yeah, Paul, yeah. I do this thing on my radio show where we play like a theme, and sometimes it was left-handed day a few weeks ago, and so there's not as many left-handed guitarists in the world of rock as you'd think. You know, Kurt Cobain.
Kurt Cobain, yeah. Right, that's another good one. You know, there's a couple of good blues ones, like Otis Rush and Albert King. I guess, you know, there's probably a lot more that I'm not thinking of, but, you know, it's like, 5% of the population?
Yeah, Tony Iommi. There you go.
There you go. That's another good one. Tony Iommi. Very good.
Hey, speaking of guitars, so, you know, back in the day, you know, recording all these records with the Cars, different things, do you save certain gear or certain guitars as, you know, just memorabilia?
I do. I have some stuff that goes back. I also loaned some stuff to the Hall of Fame Museum. They've got a nice little display, and I gave them some guitars and clothing that they could display, and I hang on to that stuff. To me, they're like, you know, I'm leaving for my daughter, you know, they're family heirlooms, you know.
I could
sell stuff and get money for it, but then I wouldn't have the stuff anymore.
right. Truer words have never been spoken, so. But I'll tell you what, man, what an honor to talk to you. I grew up in the 80s, and it's like I grew up kind of like on Sabbath and Maiden and that kind of stuff, Metallica and whatnot. But I always heard the Cars. And then about 4 years ago, I got back into vinyl, and I bought a Cars vinyl. I can't remember which one it is. And now I've got all of them because I'm like, I started listening to them. I'm like, I just put them on, and I listen to them, and it flashes back to so many great memories. And I'll be honest in saying I'm a much bigger Cars fan now at 51 than I was at 15. So it's
well, that's cool, man. I'm glad, you know, if you found a place for it in your life and dig the music, that's awesome.
And now the Empty Hearts, I gotta get that on vinyl as well. So
yeah, well, I'm sure we can arrange something. You know, some low people in high places.
Hey, Elliot, thank you so much for the time, and good luck on everything. And maybe someday you can get back out on tour, and you can come through the Motor City and say hello. So,
thank you, Meltdown, and thanks for having me on the show. And of course, when the world reopens, we're going to play Detroit. There's no question about that. And so, please come and say hello. Bring your friends and family, and we'll have a great time.
Elliot Easton on the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown Podcast. Some really good stuff right there. And yeah, who could forget that famous scene from Fast Times at Ridgemont High? Really good stuff. Moving in stereo. Every time I even say the words, all I can think of is that scene. But I'll be completely honest. Like I said in the interview, I was not a Cars fan growing up at all. I heard them on the radio. I didn't dislike them. They just weren't really in my wheelhouse when I was a kid. But all these years later, I've just become this Cars fanatic. I listen to them all the time. It's just really good to go back and check out some of this stuff from the late 70s to mid to late 80s with the Cars. I mean, go check out some of their stuff on Spotify or buy some albums or whatever. I think I bought one record. And to be honest with you, I can't remember which record it was. And I bought another one. I'm like, oh, yeah. Each record has like three, four, five songs I recognized from when I was a kid on it. And it's just some really good stuff. So, and of course, the Empty Hearts album, really good as well. Hey, guys, thank you so much for listening. Yeah, like I said, got a bunch of interviews locked and loaded for this week. So hopefully you guys will come back and check it out. In the meantime, I'm out.
Thank you for listening to Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. You can help this podcast grow by giving it a 5-star rating and writing a review on Apple and iTunes. Plus, feel free to subscribe and share it with your friends. Until next time, thanks for listening to Talkin' Rock.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.